How is it that drug companies can make huge profits from vaccines while people in the global south die from lack of access to medical care? How does the global regime of intellectual property rights enable this inequality? And what is the role of Bill Gates in defending this system? In this interview, Dr. Moga Kamalyani argues that vaccine inequality is not a market, but a policy failure. From the HIV crisis to the recent pandemic, the public has repeatedly shouldered the risk for the development of life-saving medicines, while private corporations have reaped obscene profits. How can we break Big Pharma's power and develop an alternative health system? Dr. Moga Kamalyani is the co-leader of the policy group of the People's Vaccine Alliance. She is a senior health advisor with 40 years of experience in health policy and programming with international and national health and development agencies, including multilateral agencies, NGOs, and governments. She's here in conversation with Arun Kondanani, who is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, and welcome to another interview from the Transnational Institute. My name's Arun Kondanani, and in this series of conversations, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an age of pandemics and climate breakdown. In this conversation, I met with Moga Kamalyani. Moga, thank you for joining us today. Can you begin by sharing a little bit about your background and tell us about the work you've been doing with the People's Vaccine Alliance?
Thank you for interviewing me. I'm not sure where to start. I'm a qualified doctor in my country. And after that, I practiced medicine in my country and then moved to other countries where I practiced medicines before I moved to health education, health programming in a number of countries. And then I joined Oxfam and started working on programs and advocacy, doing researches in many countries and kind of training people. And then I was instrumental in Oxfam's campaign on cut the cost of medicines in 2001. That was at the height of the HIV crisis. So I worked a lot on HIV and on access medicine. I also worked a lot on financing and delivering healthcare as well. So continued covering all that until about 2-3 years ago, I left Oxfam. And then when the People's Vaccine Alliance started in 2020, I joined the co-leader of the policy group. So my input in the People's Vaccine Alliance is on policy and advocacy issues.
Okay. And can you give us a bit of a picture of what it looks like right now across the world in terms of vaccine distribution and how equitable that has been?
Okay. So we still have glaring inequity in vaccines distribution across the world. So while people say in the UK or in Europe or in the US have their fourth dose, these people, particularly in Africa and in other low-income countries, who are still waiting for the first dose. So that just shows you that the huge difference between those countries that have bought the vaccines and the other countries that couldn't do the same. The issue started before vaccines came into being. It was clear from early 2020 when WHO announced a pandemic, it was clear that if there was a vaccine, then it wouldn't be enough for everybody. That was absolutely obvious. It's not the first time. We had the same with avian flu before, and we had the same with swine fever. So it's not a new thing that you, at the beginning of production, you don't have enough vaccines. So instead of going through a solidarity and a public health approach to distributing the vaccine, allocating the vaccine, companies went for the highest profitable market, and that fitted with rich countries hoarding the vaccines. So basically, early 2020, I think it was end of April or beginning of May, WHO, the World Health Organization, put forward what they called equitable access framework, where they identified the priority groups that should have the vaccines all over the world. So when they said health workers first, it was meaning health workers in the UK having the vaccine at the same time that health workers in Mozambique have it. Once you have all health workers, then you have older people beyond particular age, then older people beyond another age, and you go on and on like that until you have enough vaccines for all the population. Then you go for the booster doses. Now, that didn't happen. What happened was health workers first in a particular country. So the UK bought enough vaccines that can vaccinate people several times over. Canada, I think, bought vaccines enough to cover the whole population six times. The US, all the rich countries bought the vaccines that were available. As soon as they come out of the factory, they already gone somewhere. And therefore, developing countries were on the back of the queue. And it took so long to get vaccines to developing countries. I have to say that the one company that didn't go for profit and went for going for developing countries was AstraZeneca. And that's thanks to Oxford University, which invented the vaccine. And in making the agreement with AstraZeneca, they insisted on two conditions. One, prioritizing low and middle income countries. And the second one was non-profit price. And therefore, AstraZeneca price was non-profit. However, AstraZeneca is one company. What they did was they contracted or went into partnership with an Indian company so that this Indian company provides vaccine for the whole world. Of course, that's not possible. Mm-hmm. So we only had more vaccines coming to developing countries when President Biden said that he bought, that America bought vaccines from Pfizer and Moderna to go to developing countries. And that's when the vaccine shortage started to ease a little bit late last year, after people have been vaccinated here and had booster doses, maybe first, maybe second booster, or started to be some doses available for this international setup that was called COVAX, that the vaccines went to COVAX. COVAX, mm-hmm. before that, only had agreement with, well, they had agreement with several companies, but only had doses from AstraZeneca, and these were limited.
And so you talked about AstraZeneca owning Oxford University's vaccine that they developed there. So presumably that's also an example of public money being used to fund the research that then produces the intellectual property that AstraZeneca or any, I mean, the same would be true of the other vaccines as well, presumably, right? So although it's a market-based system, there's public money going into the research in the first place. Is that right?
It's absolutely right. All the vaccines had public money. All the vaccines were developed by public money. Even the mRNA vaccine that was developed by Pfizer, that Pfizer says they didn't take public money, this is not true. Because the vaccine was developed by the German company, BioNTech. Then they had an agreement with Pfizer for production. BioNTech had money from the German government. And also Pfizer had advanced purchasing money from a number of countries, including the US. So if the vaccine didn't work, the government has already paid. Just like several governments, including the UK, paid for the Merck vaccine, for example, and the GSK vaccine. These vaccines didn't work, but we took the risk as the public. So the public paid, took the whole risk of the vaccine production, but the profit was privatized. This is the stark example of how public funding results on product that is essential for public health, and then the profit is privatized. So you've got obscene profit that have never happened before. There's never drug companies making that high profit, these billions of dollars from one product in such short time. That never happened before. And that is our money. That is the public who paid for it. I don't think it's a market failure. It's a policy failure. It's our governments who invested in the R&D, invested in the de-risking production by companies, invested in paying high price for the vaccine without any conditions.
Because as you're saying, it's not that us as private individuals buy the vaccine when it's produced. It's governments, money that the client for these corporations buying the product, and they often buy in advance to remove the risk. It's public money at both ends, at the research end and at the purchase end, isn't it?
But even if as an individual, if you buy the vaccine from your own pocket, you've already paid for it from
your
own
taxes.
You know?
Right.
So it's the same, really.
And so you mentioned the manufacturing in India of vaccines. It seems that quite a lot of the manufacturing capacity for COVID vaccines is in the global south. And so these countries are making vaccines that are then mostly not supplied to people in their own country, but to the richer nations. I mean, can you explain why that is? And what would be the consequence if a government in the global south simply said, well, we're making these vaccines and we're just going to use them on our own people and violate the intellectual property rules at the global level? Like, what would be the consequences for a government that did that?
Okay, just to say, generally for vaccines like measles, whooping cough, the majority are made in developing countries, but that's because the intellectual property, the patent has passed. So they are able to produce it without worrying about being sued. Okay, so that's in the other vaccines. When it comes to vaccines that are under patent, like HPV, the cervical cancer vaccine, for example, we're not talking COVID now. These particular vaccines, the two vaccines are produced by two companies, GSK and Merck. They're still under patent, so they can't produce it unless there is a voluntary license from, say, Merck or GSK to a particular company. Until the patent expires, then the Indians or whoever has the capacity can produce them. When it comes to COVID, COVID vaccines has a bit of an issue in the sense that it's not just patent, it's also the know-how, which is also covered by intellectual property. So intellectual property is not just patent. There's lots of things about copyright, industrial design, but mainly the know-how is the issue. It's the knowledge that goes with how to make the vaccines. But these things, you know, there is intellectual property about them. Like if there's a company in India who can make them, they need the know-how and they need to be sure that nobody will take them to court. And that's not possible because somebody will take them to court. So the countries like India or whatever cannot issue compulsory license, for example, because there is no know-how to enable the company to make the vaccine. Now, with AstraZeneca, they had this agreement with Serum in India and another company in South Korea, but India is Serum is the biggest manufacturer in the world in terms of number of volume. So in that agreement, I guess they gave them the know-how to be able to make the vaccine. And the idea was that vaccine was for the South. It was for low and middle income countries. And Serum started exporting to these countries. However, because it's bilateral agreement between the company from the North and the company from the South, it's secret. It's a commercial secret. So we don't know what's in the agreement. We only realized some things in the agreement when we discovered that the price offered to Uganda and South Africa is more than the price AstraZeneca offered the European Union. So that's when, well, hey, what is that? So clearly the agreement between the two companies did not include any mention of price or allowed Serum to charge whatever they like. I'm not sure what written in it, but this is the result. Another issue was that the UK that had more vaccines or had deals on more vaccines than we need, at some stage there wasn't enough doses in the NHS here. So they got 5 million doses from India. And it was really funny. I just woke up on Radio 4, you know, Today program saying 5 million doses are coming from India and 5 million will come later. I thought, hey, what's that? You know, 10 million doses going to the UK. They're supposed to be going to Africa. And I knew at the time there were several African countries waiting for the vaccine and have no clue when they're coming or how many doses are coming. They didn't know. It was revealed afterward that in the agreement, Serum Institute, the Indian company, had to prioritize orders from AstraZeneca. And of course, AstraZeneca's agreement with the UK government that it had to prioritize delivery to the UK, and hence the 5 million doses came. I don't know what happened to the other 5 million, but I know 5 million came here. So that's the thing about going to the North. That's not meant to happen. The same happened with Canada. Canada also bought medicine from the Indian company. So it's just obscene that, you know, you have all this agreement. Our governments hoarded all the vaccines that are on the market. And if you talk to the UK at the time, they would say, oh, we paid 700 million, I think, 700 million pounds in COVAX, this international body. And that's it, like wash their hands from the vaccines. They just bought the money. What would COVAX buy If you're hoarding the whole market, what would they buy with money, with the whole money in the world, not just 700? So it's not only drug companies behaved very badly, but it's also rich governments behaved very badly. And both of them, it was a win-win for both of them, because having the doses save, I think, personally, that's not the people's vaccine thinking, it's my thinking. As a British person, I think the doses saved the politicians here. Mm-hmm. Because they failed us in responding to COVID, and the doses basically saved them. And the same in the US, possibly in Europe as well. So it was a win for them, but it also was a win for companies because they made enormous amount of money. Mm-hmm. And all that was at the expense of people in the South. So this thing about producing for the North, that's what happened, basically. It wasn't production for the North. And then when India faced the Delta variant, which was very dangerous. And, you know, if you remember, the news was covered with people dying in the street and no oxygen and this and that. So India decided to stop export of the vaccine and use all the vaccine that produced for its own people, which sounded a little bit logical, really. Everybody here and in COVAX starts screaming that, oh, India's stopping export. So India was supposed to leave its people die and export to Africa. Why don't you export and share what you have from Europe to, or from America to Africa? Right. So it was just yet another hypocrisy, really, from the West.
Can we talk a bit about the kind of intellectual property rules at the global level? So World Trade Organization founded in 1994, there's an agreement on trade-related aspects of intellectual property, TRIPS, which sets up these rules. At that time, were very strongly favorable to the pharmaceutical corporations because they create this regime of intellectual property that applies to drugs and so on, right? In 2001, there's a bit of a pushback with the Doha Declaration. Can you talk about that history and what's at stake there?
So, yeah, that was a big argument to create the TRIPS agreement. And it's actually very clever because you don't go and negotiate TRIPS. Once a country joins the WTO, automatically you sign to TRIPS. That's it, done, finished. Otherwise, stay outside WTO. And of course, you want to export and import other things. So it's not very helpful for any country to stay outside the WTO. So that's a clever thing. And it's worth remembering that in the negotiation of the TRIPS agreement, the US delegation had somebody who was from Pfizer, the drug company, and somebody from Microsoft, the software company. And that's why intellectual property was very strong. So, and it was developing countries were fighting hard against that. And that's why we have what they call flexibilities, or what, something called government use, which is like compulsory license. Then came HIV and the big crisis of HIV and the horrible picture of people in the North surviving. You know, it was really nice to see. I mean, like, I had friends who were living instead of dying. You know, I have seen people who are dying of HIV. And then I have seen people who are like, we call the medicine for HIV like the Lazarus medicine, because it was really like bringing somebody from their deathbed. So it was a picture in the North, very, very positive, very encouraging, you know. You look at the South where millions and millions of people were dying of HIV and there's no medicine because the medicine are just so expensive. At the time, we're talking about 2001, the price of a course of treatment was around $10,000 per person per year. So clearly unaffordable to any individual, to any governments, and even to donors. And I remember talking to donors and they would say, I mean, come on, we can't make that commitment because it's a life commitment. You can't say I'll fund a program for 5 years and then what? You leave the person to die? You'd be really like killing somebody if you stop the treatment. So they didn't do that. And it was only when an Indian generic company called Cipla, actually, when the CEO, Dr. Hamid, one day in a meeting said that he will offer the triple combination for $600 for government and $350, basically a dollar a day for non-government organizations. So basically, he got the price from $10,000 to $350 per person per year. He set the milestone for the price. And drug companies started somehow, miraculously, they found some efficiencies here and there to come down with the price. They never matched his price, the Indian price, but they came right down from the 10,000 to something, maybe 1,000 or something like that. So that's what was happening on HIV. And then at that time, there was a negotiation at WTO. It was what's called the Doha round, and therefore that's the meeting was in Doha in Qatar. And there was, again, a big debate about how intellectual properties are barriers for medicines. And here is the example, HIV. So we took HIV as an example. It's not the only exception. It is an example of what's happening. And after a lot of negotiation and a lot of argument by companies and by the countries that defend the company, they came up with what's called Doha Declaration, which says that nothing in the TRIPS agreement stops or prohibits or should prohibit countries from taking measures to make medicines available and affordable. So basically, while it didn't say stop intellectual property, it says nothing should stop you from using any public health measures to make the medicines available and affordable. And in that way, the way we see it is that it put public health above or before commercial interest. That's what happened. There was a big argument about making it specific to HIV or naming some diseases like HIV, TB, and malaria. But in the end, it didn't really name a particular disease. So that was very useful that countries and companies that can make these medicines will do it, and countries can issue compulsory license. So India issued compulsory license, Thailand issued compulsory license, Brazil threatened to issue compulsory license and got prices right down by the threat. Thailand issued compulsory license, but at hell, absolute hell. So despite Doha, the European Commission wrote to the government threatening them. The US also threatened Thailand, but they already issued the compulsory license and imported the medicine from India. So it was useful in that sense. Mm-hmm. Then came COVID. Do you want me to talk about COVID?
Yeah, absolutely.
So in October 2020, India and South Africa made a proposal to the World Trade Organization to have a temporary waiver on intellectual property. And they named the intellectual properties that are relevant to COVID. So like patent, data, know-how, which they call trade secrets, and a couple of other things. And they said, we have temporary waiving, you know, basically stopping intellectual property rule on products related to COVID. So basically tests, treatment, vaccines, protective equipment, you know, whatever is relevant to COVID, so that producers in developing countries can produce and have enough supply for the countries. And because if you have four or five companies producing something and competing, then the price will come down. So it's the market works and makes it affordable. So that was the waiver. Over 100 countries supported the waiver, developing countries. And a whole kind of like loads and loads of civil society, loads of ex-ministers, ex-prime ministers, member of parliament from globally, academics, economists, all Nobel Prize winners, all these people and all these governments supported that waiver because they expected, as I said, that if you have a vaccine, it wouldn't be enough. Or if you have a medicine, whatever we'll have, it wouldn't be enough. And it took 18 months roughly to come with a decision. And basically, the rich countries, the EU, the US, Canada, Switzerland, all Japan, all these people were against it. So you've got most of the lower middle-income countries are for it, and you've got a bunch of rich countries are against it, and there was a deadlock in the WTO. Mm-hmm. And they ask a million questions. So the rich countries, they ask, we want evidence on how intellectual property is a barrier. We want evidence on your need for the vaccines. Which vaccine? It's an incredible amount of questions which developing countries answered beautifully, to the extent that particularly the UK kept asking the same question. And at one stage, South Africa put 40 pages of reply. And all that is online. If you go to WTO online, you'll find it. They still ask the same question in different way. Eventually, last June, they had a kind of a compromise. It was a major compromise, to be honest. And basically, a compromise on clarifying one article in the TRIPS agreement, which basically makes it easier to produce for export. So like TRIPS agreement allow you to produce for your own market. But of course, that's, you know, not every country has the capacity to produce. So you need the export thing. So they made that smooth on patent and only limited to vaccines. So limited to vaccine, limited to patent. When, remember, I said for patent, we need the know-how. Mm-hmm. So it has really limited application. But it, what it says is that the deadline for agreeing on extending this thing to cover medicine and tests, COVID medicine tests, the deadline to come to an agreement is 17th of December, so basically next week. So since June until now, again, they asked the question, God knows how many times. So after you finish, the EU ask and ask and ask, and then Switzerland ask and ask, and then Canada, then Japan, then they get Singapore, they get Mexico, they get Taiwan, ask the same question, but in different ways. And South Africa and others produce similar answer. And Egypt kind of say, hey, you know, we answered this. Here is the answer. Ask again. So they want evidence and they want exactly which medicine. And how many doses do you want from that medicine? In every country, I mean, kind of like, you know, when you put questions just to stop people doing or asking for something. So instead of saying no, and I heard that in Geneva last week, where developing country, I heard it from a delegate from developing countries. He said to me, what we wanted from them, and they'd say yes or no. We just had enough of asking and us providing answer and them asking and us providing answer. Just say you don't want it and just be clear about it instead of all this coming and going. But of course, they wouldn't do that because they would face a lot of opposition in their own countries, you know, here in the UK or in the US or wherever. They would be. So instead of saying no, they just keep delaying and keep delaying. Mm-hmm. So we don't know what will happen next week in their meeting, but there's no agreement. Basically, developing countries are still saying, yes, extend. And rich countries are saying, no, we don't have enough evidence. And the US said that they're going to find some American authority to investigate the issue before they can make a position. Mm-hmm. So, you know, okay, you know, take your time to investigate. And I think this is intentional, just like what they did on vaccines. They kept delaying the vaccine decision at the time when there was severe shortage of vaccines, where if there was a decision with allowing the know-how and the no patent, then companies would have made enough doses for the South. They waited until the end of the year and then middle of this year, by which time there are some doses available for developing countries. So they say, oh, there are doses. What do you want it for? And I think for the medicine, they're waiting for the same. And we keep saying, and developing countries keep saying, this is not for a one particular medicine. These are for the medicines that are also coming in the pipeline, who may be more effective than that one medicine that's in the market, who may have better scope. Like, it doesn't matter if you're taking that medicine or the other medicine for another health issue, because that one has limitation, but the new ones may not have that limitation. They might cure COVID, and we don't have a cure so far. So they might have, you know, this potential that the new medicines will have much more advantages than what we have. And we want the extension of this decision to cover these new medicines as well, not one or two medicines, existing medicine. And because the know-how with medicines is not that important in the sense that companies can make it with very little know-how. They can figure it out. But drug companies don't want that. Drug companies are making billions out of these medicines on top of the billions they made out of the vaccine. So they don't want the developing countries to produce. They want to keep the monopoly in their hand. And our countries, our governments in the North are allowing that. Our governments in the South are struggling to get the doses in their countries.
Mm-hmm. And can I ask you about the large kind of global health-based NGOs, like, for example, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation? So you talked earlier about the temporary waiver. They supported the temporary waiver. They were one of the groups advocating for the temporary waiver. But they also seem to have lobbied Oxford University right at the beginning of the process when they just developed their vaccine to try and get Oxford University to make its vaccine available as intellectual property owned by AstraZeneca, rather than what they originally seeming to want to do at Oxford was to distribute it at low cost or no charge. So there seems to be an ambiguous role there. What's your reading of their role?
Okay, so let's be accurate. There is a difference between non-government organizations, NGOs, whether it's local or international. So international, like Medicines on Frontier, MSF, Oxfam, Public Citizen, all these people, they are international NGOs. They're non-profit and they have different ways of operation from the likes of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. The Gates Foundation is run by two people, by the Gates people, and it's poured money in various projects and various policies and things. So the Gates Foundation was against the waiver from the beginning. And in fact, I think they influenced the institutions where Gates has a big influence, like Gavi and therefore COVAX. So COVAX and Gavi, we talked several times with the leaders and said, why don't you join the WHO technology access pool, where the idea is to pool intellectual property and know-how and technology in one place and then sublicense to companies that can make a product. And they were adamant against that. They were adamant against anything to touch intellectual property. Bill Gates, on record, is saying that it has nothing to do with intellectual property. So did Gavi, so did the other. And it was only when the U.S. said, well, okay, we will accept a waiver on vaccines, that's when Gates said, well, maybe IP has a role or something to that extent. And if you think about it, their position is very logical, because the Microsoft makes its money out of intellectual property. So it's logical that they support intellectual property. They invest in drug companies. So again, it's logical that they support something that is supported or that something is important for drug companies. So no, Gates Foundation is different. And as I say, they are against anything that touches intellectual property rules.
I mean, sometimes these kind of conversations about intellectual property can sound a little abstract, but obviously we're in the end talking about the ability to save lives, aren't we? And is it possible to do a rough kind of sense of numbers here of what, how many lives might we have saved if we had a different regime around intellectual property? Or is that too, require us to be too speculative?
Well, I mean, there are some estimates. Actually, I'm working on some estimates right now. But the figure that we know was that there's 12 million people died of HIV because of lack of affordability. Mm-hmm. So this is 12 million lives. Add to that the lives that were destroyed around them. I mean, if these people, particularly if these people were women, that means the whole family, their life was shattered, basically. Mm-hmm. But these people died because there was medicine, but mm-hmm. the medicine wasn't affordable to them.
Mm-hmm. What's the picture with COVID?
Well, I mean, you know, look at the death of COVID in low and middle income countries. And if there is a vaccine, or if there was a vaccine, or if there was medicine available for these people, certainly the deaths will be less. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't tell you how many.
Sure.
Because there's still, despite the vaccines, there's people who die in the U.S. But actually, the U.S. is not a good example, because the U.S., the vaccination level in the U.S. is not as high as should have been, given that they have the vaccine. Mm-hmm. But find the figures in the U.K. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be something like that.
Mm-hmm. And can you say a little about what it would look like? Like, what would be the alternative here, that if we've moved away from a system of developing and distributing vaccines that is centered on profits for corporations and an idea of the market as a system of making decisions and distributing? If we moved away from that, what would the alternative look like in broad terms?
Okay. So If you talk about pandemics, there's general medicine, vaccines, and there's pandemics. So if we just take pandemics, we're not, for a start, we're not against profit. But logically, we're against obscene profit when people are dying. I mean, that just logically, morally, whatever, it doesn't, ethically, it doesn't make sense. It's just wrong. And it doesn't make things from a public health point of view, because if, you know, the virus doesn't respect borders, you can't say I vaccinated the UK, for example, population five times, five doses, 10 doses, therefore we're safe. We're not, because a variant can come from somewhere else and hit the UK. So it doesn't make even public health sense. So in that case, you make profit, but not obscene profit. So if the government is putting all that money in R&D, in research and development, and that's how it should happen, that's why we had a vaccine in a record time, because there was record amount of money gone there. Then you have conditionalities. And the conditionalities is, we'll give you the money, we want you to share the technology and the IP. And once that's shared, then we have vaccines and medicine, whatever, for everybody in the world. And everybody has a little bit of profit. These big companies, the other companies, the smaller companies in the South, has a little bit of profit. But the final value is in everybody is protected and everybody is safe. Mm-hmm. And there are several things that can be used. I mean, the idea is that linking financing R&D with the price and the supply, that you know, who rules basically afterward, this is the fundamental problems, because drug companies will always say, we pay for R&D, and therefore we have to dictate the price and the supply, and we have to have intellectual property. So the debate became, rather than how to produce medicine that is needed and sell it at affordable price, the debate has become how to protect intellectual property. So protect one means of production rather than protect the way to get the production. So what we as civil society and other people promote is separating, or what we call delinking, financing research and development from the products that will happen. Mm-hmm. So you can finance it in many, many ways, direct public financing, tax exemption, prize funds. There's many ways of financing. And once it's financed by the public, then the price is dictated in a different way. And the sharing of knowledge happens, and therefore you have more producers. Mm-hmm. But drug companies don't want that, because if you put financing away from the product, then how can they charge high price? Because then you will know exactly how much the product costs. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing they don't want. There is no transparency on the whole value chain of medicines, no transparency. And they fight against that. So there's no transparency about the cost of research and development or production or any cost. There's no transparency on patents. Mm-hmm. If a country has the capacity to put all the patents on the website, like some of the US, it does. Try to find patents in the UK, absolute hell. Then, you know, let alone try to find it in other countries. Mm-hmm. Because the company who can say, I filed in X and Y and Z countries, don't say that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so there's no transparency on price. Do we know in the UK how much our government paid for various vaccines for COVID? No. You just get the price from kind of like indirect ways, but there's no direct way of saying it. A few years ago, there was a cancer medicine, breast cancer medicine, produced by Roche, the French company, and it was rejected by NICE, the British agency that decide which drug goes to NHS, can go to the NHS. Not because the drug was bad, but because it was highly priced. So we campaigned, some individuals campaigned against that and wrote to the minister at the time and saying, you know, issue compulsory license on it because there are companies that can produce it. They no, no, no. So they went and negotiated with the company, and eventually they came with, okay, we negotiated a lower price, or the company said that they were going to offer it to the UK at a lower. What is that price? Not your business to know as a British citizen. Mm-hmm. It's not your business to know. So there isn't transparency about that. So we need transparency on all aspects of medicine production, but the companies are utterly against that. All they say is that every so often there is one, like a department in one university in the US, Tufts University, which produces every, I think, 2 years or 3 years, they produce an estimation to how much it costs for the cost of R&D to produce a medicine, and it goes to the market. And that increase, I remember when we started campaigning, I was in Oxford at the time, it was $500 million to get a drug to the market. And then a couple of years ago, I think 2017 or something, it was about $2.3 billion to get it. And I remember I was in a meeting, was a CEO of a company, and he was justifying this by saying the cost of R&D is very high. And I said to him, are you going to just, you know, expect the price to increase all the time, the cost to increase every year? And he looked at me and he said, yes. And I said to him, but that's not sustainable. You know, even rich countries will not be able to buy these medicines because they're highly priced. And he didn't have an answer.
That's incredible. Thank you.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between Dr. Moga Kamal Yani, the co-leader of the policy group of the People's Vaccine Alliance, and TNI associate Arun Kondanani. Be sure to check out previous episodes in the series and do keep an eye out for upcoming episodes. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from, and to please write us a review, which can only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us, and be sure to tune in next time.